IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. Over the course of a couple of years between 1942 and 1944, right amid the storm of the Second World War, anywhere between 2 to 3 million Indians died in Bengal. Remember, this was undivided Bengal, so it's both West Bengal and what is today Bangladesh. And now these people weren't killed by Japanese arms. There were no swarms of Japanese bombers darkening the skies of rural Bengal and raining destruction. What really happened was that these millions of people, most of whom were poor and most of whom were nameless, died of hunger and of disease born of hunger. And, you know, the Bengal famine remains one of the most traumatic events in recent history of India. And most scholars today agree that it was at its heart a human catastrophe, a catastrophe made by human decisions, though obviously acts of God played a role. Now, to discuss the Bengal famine and what lessons it might hold for us today as we grapple with a very different situation, but also a very drastic situation, the global pandemic, I'm joined by Anirudh and Sarthak. Welcome, guys. I want to start, Sarthak, by just laying some context for our listeners. What was Bengal like? What was its economy and its social structure like before the war, before the famine?
So, as you said, to understand the Bengal famine, we need to understand what was the economic and the economic situation and the social fabric of Bengal. Now, Bengal was a predominantly agrarian economy. And again, a large proportion of the population was, again, economically backward. Yes, there were certain sections which were the Bhadralok, the upper classes, but predominantly the larger section of the society was poor. In fact, in the rural areas, the poverty levels were so high that almost half to three-fourths of the population was in a semi-starved situation. And the population had been increasing over a period of time, primarily because of improvements related to the mortality rate. The mortality rate had been going down. Healthcare and all these things had improved. But the agricultural production had not increased in equal pace. So agricultural productivity did not improve. So per capita rice availability was not very high. So food was not sufficient. And what is famine? Famine is nothing but lack of food. And Bengal was considered to be a province of rice growers and rice eaters. So already people were in a semi-starved situation. On top of that, one major cushion that is provided during the times of crisis is land. Now, when it comes to access to land, there also we find major issues. The Bengal society was divided along multiple layers. We must keep one thing in mind that it was Bengal province where permanent settlement was started by the British government. So the society was divided along lines. So one class was there, which were the Jamidas, who were the owners of the land. But then there were those who were cultivating on the land owned by the Jamidas who did not have the land rights. Those who were the roads or the Bargadas, etc., etc. And in between, there were the Jotedars, who were the wealthy peasants. So a large section of the population did not have access to land, which could have given them that cushioning effect during the time of crisis, which was also not there. So this is the background when it comes to the Bengal famine.
That's really the foundations, as it were, for the crisis that eventually began to unfold, right? As the Japanese began to move into Burma, the British Raj began to get extremely paranoid about them potentially using Bengal's rice supplies, Bengal's transportation infrastructure as a launching pad for an invasion of most of India. And as a result of this fear, what the officials of the Raj did was go to this already semi-starved province and go out and start to destroy stocks of grain and stocks of rice. This was not something that the people of Bengal really took lying down. This is something that they fought back. They realized very well what the British were doing, but they were simply not able to stand up to the power of the Raj. The Raj went out and basically destroyed most of Bengal's riverine transport infrastructure as well, which made it very, very difficult for people to be moving grain through legitimate supply channels, which made it difficult for harvest equipment, for seeds and so on and so forth to reach the place where it had to be. So all these things combined, as you can see, you already had a semi-starved population, you already had these stratifications on lines of caste, you already had limitations on land productivity and so on and so forth, were then given a new shock by the destruction of existing stocks, by the destruction of infrastructure, and that began to lead to a crisis. But I believe, Sadhak, there was something else that was going on at the time, right? Since this was a wartime scenario, I think the government was spending massively. There was inflation, a lot of prices, which led to a fall in real wages. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. So during the time of wars, generally you will be having inflation. So this is something that they were also grappling with. So the value of the money that people have is going down. Apart from this, what has happened, the thing that you mentioned, that they went ahead with some denial policies. One is they are denying rice. So especially to the eastern part, southern part of Bengal, what they had done, they had destroyed the food, rice and all these things, so that the advancing Japanese army will not be able to utilize it. On top of that, they had dismantled all the transportation infrastructure. Also, the supply chain that was there with Burma when it comes to import of rice, that was also dismantled. So at that point of time, Bengal used to import rice from Burma. So now that is also not there. On top of this, inflation is there. So whatever wages you have, the real wages, the value of that has gone down now. So it was very difficult for people to procure the basic necessities.
So not only do they have less money to pay for necessities, but the necessities are also just not available even if they want.
Yeah. And see, one more thing. Another thing was why these necessities were not there. At that point of time, the provincial governments also had the power to impose different kind of trade barriers. So the adjacent provinces, they also impose these trade barriers. So transportation of rice from maybe Bengal to Orissa, all these things got restricted. So or you already have an issue, on top of these issues are there. Apart from this, the government back then imposed price control mechanisms. And as they imposed price controls that you cannot sell rice beyond a particular limit, it led to massive hoarding. So if there is hoard, because the producers, they are not getting sufficient remuneration out of it. So hoarding, black marketing, all these things happened. So it made the situation even worse.
As you can expect, like when you see hoarders refusing to release stocks because it's just not remunerative for them to do that, the British Raj actually went out and confiscated supplies from these hoarders and then moved them to government godowns. So what happened in the process was that even legitimate suppliers, right, the very last leg of the supply chain, we've talked about how from the very, very beginning of this agrarian supply chain, the people who are farming are all being affected, all the way down to the people in the cities who actually own stores and mills are now having their stuff confiscated by the government. So there's shocks that are being imposed due to government activity at every single level of the supply chain. And what that leads to is an unprecedented scarcity of rice across the entire province, and millions of people start to move to Kolkata.
Now, Anirudh, one thing has to be noted here. This scarcity is not impacting everyone equally, because there was a section of population who were very influential. And what they're doing, they're suggesting the government that why not come up with a particular scheme which ensures the availability of basic necessities for certain sections of the population. Now, who are these certain sections? Those who are participating in the war, those who are the civil servant, and then those who are in the upper classes. So you are having some foodstuff scheme back then, which ensures basic necessities like food, so food stocks will be transferred to these sections of the population. So those who are at the bottom of the hierarchy, they are the ones who are massively impacted. Also, the other goods, not just food, the other goods, the industries were producing this. But here also, there had been different kind of controls. Now, a large part of the commodities which were being produced by the industries were procured by the British government in India, which was again shipped to Britain. So these goods were procured at a fixed price and which used to be low. But if these industries have to sell it outside, the prices used to be very high. So already you don't have money, you don't have rice. And at the same time, these manufactured goods, you cannot access them because they are at a very, they will be available at a very high rate. And the remaining ones were going to the British government. So all these things led to massive disruption in the economic life of the people.
So let me just try and summarize what the points you guys have been making. First, you have a time of almost Malthusian pressures where you have a rising population. And at the same time, agricultural productivity, agricultural output has not increased. So there is a systemic possibility of food shortages. Second, the war actually causes a massive disruption and the British basically panic in 1942 and destroy essentially the agrarian infrastructure of Bengal. You know, the British destroyed something like more than 40,000 boats out of a supply of about 60,000. And these boats are absolutely critical for transporting agricultural produce, for getting people from one place to another. So these sort of acts actually completely devastate the social structure and economy. Sarthak, you pointed out, there are fundamental barriers created by British decisions. You have these provincial trade barriers. You have hoarding. You have the British supplying relief of some sort to more affluent people, the people who probably need it the least. And then on top of all this, you can broadly classify the mishandling of the Bengal famine into three categories. One would be the sort of Amartya Sen understanding, which is that it's basically an example of gross negligence and mismanagement. The other is that there was also some malign intent involved, which is the argument that, of course, Madhusree Mukherjee makes in her book, Churchill's Secret War. And the third is Janam Mukherjee, another historian, has also argued that the Bengal famine was impinged on communal and other fault lines that already existed in Bengal. And it played out along those lines. So people weren't necessarily passive receptors of this catastrophe, but they actually shaped it, they reacted to it, they worsened it in some ways. And, you know, we hear about those stories of people streaming into Calcutta, skeletal figures really streaming into Calcutta. We hear much less about the fact that hungry people, starving people went out and looted. They looted lorries, they looted stores because they just needed food to eat.
In some cases, they even fought against officials that were trying to push them into relief camps because they knew perfectly well the relief camps would have absolutely miserable conditions, and they preferred to try and survive or die by themselves on the streets of Calcutta rather than accede to a system they knew was not willing to really care for them anyway.
That anecdote that you just pointed out, you know, it highlights the nature of governance during this time. And it's all quite grim. What lessons would a catastrophe like this hold for us today? I mean, Bengal famine offers us examples of price controls, of lockdowns, if you will. What do we learn from this tragic episode?
Okay, so I would think that the first and biggest lesson that should be learned from the Bengal famine is about accountability of a government, right? The British Raj was able to get away with misinformed, callous, sometimes absolutely malicious decisions because there were very few ways to hold them accountable from the side of the Indian public. Even leaders of the Indian National Congress, for example, when they knew the supply situation was getting worse and worse in Bengal, according to Janam Mukherjee, did not necessarily bring it up with the British as intensely as they could have or should have, because they had their eyes on the bigger goal of independence. We also, according to Janam Mukherjee, there's a lot of industrialists, especially Marwadi industrialists based in Bengal around the time, who made massive profits from selling to the government, who were also major donors to the INC, but didn't necessarily put too much pressure on the British Raj to try and ease up the situation. A lot of these people later became great philanthropists because of the desperate situations that a lot of Bengalis were reduced to. This might also have fed into inflamed communal tensions because a lot of these industrialists tended to prefer to hire people from a certain religious community. One very interesting line that has stayed with me from his book, Hungry Bengal, has been this argument that there have been a lot of studies that look at the economic impacts of the Great Depression, of hyperinflation during the days of the Weimar Republic, and how they led to, for example, the rise of fascism, the rise of Nazism. But there hasn't necessarily been studies like that that look at how these socioeconomic shocks that were imposed during the colonial period led to partition. There's almost this sense that partition was inevitable, that Hindus and Muslims were simply not able to get along. But one really interesting learning for me was that it was because of the stresses that were put on Bengal social fabric. It was because of the unraveling that the Bengal famine imposed that partition happened. And one thing that I cannot stop thinking about is the fact that during the Bengal famine, as today, various sectors of society face very, very different costs from a response to a disaster, right? In the case of the famine, the Bhadralok was more or less emphasized by the British government for relief supplies and so on and so forth, because they needed them as administrators, as industrial workers. And these people were able to basically comply with the British. They didn't necessarily have a choice in the matter. They were able to pay for higher food, and so they did. Whereas the vast majority of people, those that the government saw as being expendable, those to whom the government was not accountable, those to whom the government didn't really see an immediate use for, were left to die. I'm not saying that modern democratic India is in as dire a situation. I think a lot of state governments have done a pretty good job. A lot of state governments do feel that their accountability towards their populations and are trying very hard to kind of alleviate the suffering of the poorest peoples. But at the same time, I don't necessarily see a lot of respect being given to these poor people's choices. For example, very recently in both Bandra and in Surat, you had a very large number of migrant workers who were terrified, hadn't been getting food properly, want to return home. But because of the fact that we are in a national pandemic, this is basically has been described by a lot of people as being a wartime situation, they were cracked down upon with absolutely brutal force. Stuff like that, you know, stuff like that where large sections of society feel like the government isn't responsive to their needs can lead to fear spreading, can lead to mistrust spreading, and can start to erode the social fabric, which can have very dangerous economic consequences down the line. And especially in times of a pandemic, you can imagine that mass crowding is definitely not going to help reduce the spread of a disease.
Yeah, which is one of those absolutely unintended consequences that can have catastrophic consequences. You know, obviously we recognize that the political situation today is completely different. Also, a pandemic, while we talk about it as if it were war, is different from war, though it has some commonalities. But Sarthak, we've also seen during these last few weeks in the lockdown some other unintended consequences. For example, we've seen disruption of food supply chains, and we've seen panic buying. We've seen hoarding of food. These were not supposed to happen. Why are they happening?
So one basic takeaway that I have from this entire scenario is, just like any other discipline, physics, chemistry, same thing applies for economics. Even during the time of crisis, you should not be forgetting the laws of economics. But the government has not somewhere followed these kind of things, and which has maybe created these kind of problems. For example, there have been hoarding, there have been price controls of different things, which has led to hoarding, which again leads to these kind of problems that people want it, they can't get it. So there is a black market for that. Also, the different kind of unintended consequences. When you are creating a policy, you have to take all these things into consideration before announcing it or declaring it. But since there was not sufficient amount of time, I feel there was not much preparation as a result of which these problems emerged. And for example, in the agriculture sector, food beverages sector, the demand, I don't think would have gone down because most of them will be essential commodities. But because there are barriers imposed to movement of food from one province to another, or within the province, within the cities, within the towns itself, the guys, the delivery guys, the logistics guys, they have faced problems. We are not getting it. We are not getting the supplies on time, or the sufficient amount of supplies are not there. So I feel the rules of economics applies even during the time of crisis, and we should be applying them. We possibly have not learned from some of the crises in the past.
So unlike in 1942 to 1944, we don't have food shortages. We don't have a rice basket being taken out of the market like Burma was in 1942. We actually have fairly abundant food supplies in India. The problem is about distribution, about getting the food to people who need it. The problem is how do you feed migrant workers who live on daily wages. The problems have been, how do you instruct police to let through a truck that maybe is transporting packaging material that is used for packaged food stuff? So, you know, it's those sort of administrative decisions, as well as, you know, the requirement, as Sarthak pointed out, of economic literacy. Amartya Sen has actually talked about this, hasn't he, Anirudh?
Yeah, so in his recent article, he's made very similar arguments to what we're saying, in the sense that while there are some similarities to a war, we shouldn't assume that it requires the same level of like absolute centralized control. It doesn't require the same amount of totalitarian impulse as wars often seem to generate. One thing that happened during the Bengal famine, for example, was that the British authorities grew extremely drunk on the fact that they have wartime powers. They were able to use wartime exigencies as a way to basically imprison opposition leaders and to take absolutely draconian measures that further worsened the supply situation. Right. Strangely enough, it doesn't really seem like Indian administrators have learned too much from that. They are saying that it's a moment of national pandemic. Therefore, we can impose a lockdown. Therefore, we have the absolute authority to stop supply chains of this, that, whatever. So Amartya Sen's argument is that participatory democracy is the way to solve this, right? By actually listening to the people who are going to be most impacted by the lockdown, by formulating policies that take their needs into account, we can start to address these problems. If you look at, for example, the fact that the initial lockdown was announced with barely 4 hours of notice, which immediately led to mass panicking, which led to mass crowding, which led to panic buying and so on and so forth, that could easily have been managed through better communication. A lot of countries right now have basically deputy prime ministers. Vietnam, for example, the deputy prime minister does almost daily briefings on the nation's state of readiness, on the state of the COVID pandemic. Some states like Kerala, for example, do fairly frequent briefings with health ministers, chief ministers. But that's not necessarily something that we're seeing in most Indian states. I would cynically say that that's partly because not all Indian states see themselves as equally accountable or equally vulnerable to the electorate. Optimistically, perhaps they assume that because of the fact that the lockdown has been imposed, because we aren't doing enough testing, that the pandemic isn't really that serious. But I am concerned that as lockdowns are lifted, as lockdowns are phased down, we are going to see increasing rates of infection. And then the only way to resolve that is by learning from the lessons of the Bengal famine.
So what were those lessons again, Anirudh?
I would say the first and foremost is to ensure that there is transparency and accountability in how the response is happening. I'm not saying that isn't there, but I'm saying that it needs to be brought up to absolutely global standards, right? Make sure the public is absolutely on board, knows why measures are being taken, make sure the public's needs are considered, not just in terms of keeping them alive through the pandemic, not just in terms of preventing them from getting infected by the pandemic, but also in terms of basic necessities, such as ensuring that they have food supplies, ensuring they have hygiene products, stuff like that. The second is to recognize that a disaster response doesn't affect all sections of society equally. So you have to adopt different means of getting aid to different sections of society. You have to adopt different means of communicating the different sections. For example, while the middle classes would be very happy to tune in to a broadcast by a political leader, the lower classes might require a community engagement, might require religious leaders to be reassuring them. And I think another really big thing to be concerned about is the fact that fear and misinformation are already spreading, right? So one thing that happened during the famine was there was a constant fear of a second famine while the first famine was still going on. There was all kinds of fear-mongering, rumor-mongering that one religious group or the other religious group was discriminating against the others, that one religious group was being worse affected than the others. But that led almost directly to the 1946 Calcutta riots. That's something that needs to be urgently addressed by both political leaders and the state apparatus like the police. And finally, I think the single biggest learning, of course, would be don't mess with supply chains. The private sector are the only guys that have anything approaching the capacity to deliver the kind of aid, both medical and food-wise, that's required to large sections of the population. By imposing price controls, by imposing export controls, all that the government does is worsen the supply situation, lead to shocks in a system that's working just fine as it is, and potentially cause a lot more harm than good.
Also ensure that you do not coerce the private sector. You have to ensure that they have incentives so that they can continue using their expertise wherever it is required.
Exactly.
That's actually very well summarized. Thank you so much. Because one of the things that you guys have highlighted is that unlike in a war, we don't need that degree of coercion. And it's really important for governments to be transparent in their communication. Remember, the virus that causes COVID-19 cannot overhear what we're talking. It doesn't know what we're discussing. It doesn't know how we plan to tackle this pandemic. So transparent, open communication is absolutely critical. Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Aditya.
And thank you for joining us on All Things Policy.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is at IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle at TakshashilaINST or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week. Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.